Wow. And here I was trying to be subtle.
That was the gavel.
All right. Well, welcome everybody. Want to be sensitive to your time. I appreciate everybody being here this afternoon. Thank you. We'll go ahead and get started. And if we, because it's a new year and we have some new faces, we don't have this officially as an agenda item, but we're going to call it under introductions. So we'll go ahead and start as around the room with introductions. I am Sean Milne, the chair of the Wasatch Front Economic Development District. I'm going to start over here.
Rick Fairbanks with the Ogden Industrial Development Corporation and Wet Corner. I don't know where Stains Club came from.
I'm Ben Becker with Science Public Finance. We're just doing a presentation on the SEDS update.
I'm Susie Decker with Finance.
Kyle Attender, Weber State University, New Economic Development Corp.
Scott Parkinson, Weber Economic Development Corp, along with Rick and Ogden Industrial Development Corporation.
Gage Frohr, Weber County Commission, former state legislator.
Chris Williams, Davis School District.
Ty Bailey, Morgan City Manager.
Tina County, Morgan County Council.
And I'm Sean Miller with Tooele County Commission.
Scott Hess, staff for the WPDB.
I'm Abby Osborne with the Salt Lake Chamber.
Andrew Gruber, I'm Executive Director here at Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Ted Knowlton, Deputy Director at Wasatch Front Regional Council.
Will Summercorn, Acting Director of the Department of Regional Development at Salt Lake County, and I'm here in place of Carlton Christensen, who recently departed, not that way, departed the county and went to UTA, is serving as one of the Board of Trustees at UTA.
Debbie Nguyen, Tooele City Mayor.
Chris Sloan, Group 1 Real Estate representing Tooele County.
Katie Gerard, Wasatch Front staff.
Bob Dandoy, Roy City.
Jeff Edwards with the Utah Advanced Materials Initiative.
Thomas Wadsworth, Governor's Office of Economic Development.
Excellent, thank you. Let's go ahead and get started and go through the staff too.
I'm Megan Christensen, Davis County Economic Development.
Sean Hughes, Davis County Economic Development.
Kent Anderson, Economic Development Director, City West Fort.
Lee Davenport, Wasatch Front Regional Council staff. Chrissy Milberg, Wasatch Front staff.
Casey Cole, Salt Lake Business Development.
Roberta Reichelt, Salt Lake City Economic Development.
Liesl Lindbergh, Salt Lake City Economic Development.
Excellent. Well, welcome, everybody. We appreciate you being here again. Our first agenda action item is approval of the minutes of our last meeting from November 19th. If you'll take a moment to review those if you haven't had an opportunity already. While folks are reviewing it, just as a matter of protocol, we don't believe we have anybody on the phone, but I'll use this opportunity now to ask, is there anyone on the phone? Hearing no one, that'll be noted. And we'll hear them chime in, right, Katie?
We actually don't have it on today. We didn't have a call in number.
Oh, we didn't? Okay. Well, then that's, we really won't hear them. If anyone has a motion, the chair would entertain it as to the minutes.
I'll make a motion that we approve the minutes from the November 19th meeting.
We'll second. Second. Abby will second. Okay, so we have a motion and then a second on approval as they've been presented. Any further discussion? Seeing no one, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed or abstain? Will be noted as unanimous. Excellent. So the next item is public comment. Is there anyone from the public that would like to comment on any of our items? Seeing and hearing none, we'll move right along to our next action item, which is a vote for chair and vice chair committee positions. So I've had the opportunity and honor, sincerely, to serve right behind Carlton Christensen, speaking with him, as our first official chair of the EDB after we stood it up as a committee for research purposes the first couple of years. For the last several, I've been chair, and I've really considered it an honor. I appreciate the support and the great work that we've done for our region. So it's time to let go of the mantle and to hand that baton off to review the process. Andrew Gruber, I'll turn some time over to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for a little bit longer. Just briefly, the Wasatch Front Economic Development District, as most of you know, is housed within the Wasatch Front Regional Council. But it exists actually as a separate committee that has appointments from the COGS, the Councils of Governments around the region, and also private sector members. So there's public sector and private sector, and that way it's unique of our committees. That's the way an economic development district is set up, a mix of public and private. For all of our other committees, we have a nominating committee, Wasatch Front Regional Council Nominating Committee, that makes nominations for the chair and vice chair of the council and its committees. Technically, this group selects its own chair and vice chair. Nonetheless, our nominating committee did think about and has a recommendation to this group for the next chair going forward. May I say that?
Yes, please.
Abby Osborne from the Chamber of Commerce, reflecting from the Salt Lake Chamber. We have had a public sector chair, and their recommendation now is to go to Abby as a private sector chair. This group has to vote on that. Now, for vice chair, the recommendation would be to not actually make that selection right now, and here's why. The way the appointments are made to this body is, again, a little different than our other committees in that each of the COGs in the region, the Council of Government, makes appointments. Those appointments are still happening through the course of this month. The Weber Area COG has met. Davis COG, Tooele, Morgan, Salt Lake have yet to meet and make their official nominations or appointments to this group. So our suggestion would be, and the nominating committee's suggestion is, go ahead with appointing a chair of this group, and then let the other appointments happen from the COGS in the region to make sure we're all filled out on who the members are, and then have those members have a dialogue about who else to add, because it is part of the responsibility of the COG appointees to also make appointments, other appointments to this group, and then to our broader strategy committee for economic development. So the point being, suggestion, appoint Abby as the chair, and then pause, let the COGS do the rest of their work, and then have a further discussion with those COG appointees as to the other members, and then also to the vice chair, and then that can be acted upon at the next meeting. The only other thing I'll say while I'm talking here is about Abby. I'm not a member of this group, so I don't have a vote in this, but we at WFRC have worked very closely with Abby for years now, and one of the things that we so greatly appreciate is Abby's total commitment to public-private cooperation. Many of you have worked with Abby over the years and have seen that firsthand. So she's been a great partner for WFRC, for me personally as well, and brings an energy and decisiveness that's
red,
helpful.
Apparently.
Uh-huh. And so from our staff perspective, we wholeheartedly support the recommendation from the nominating committee. But it's up to you. Mr. Chairman, back to you.
Thank you, Andrew. We appreciate the explanation of the process and all the work that's gone into that. So without further ado, again, I've really appreciated the opportunity to be a part of this organization since when Denise was a wee advisor to the board, and we were conjuring up how to finally make good on the opportunities that the PDD allows us with the EDA grants, and really appreciate your work. I know Scott has done a really good job of coming on board, but I'd be remiss if I didn't acknowledge your years of coaching Carlton and I as we were chairs. So after 4+ years, it is time, and the chair would entertain a motion as to your new chair after the recommendation that we've received.
I would so move that Abby Osborne be replaced as chair.
Thank you, Commissioner. We have a motion and a second by Tina.
Can we ask real quickly? I'm assuming she's on board with this, but let's.
Oh,
she's
in the room, so let's give her an opportunity to say.
Yeah, I'm ready. Usually we wait till they head to the restroom and then do it.
True. Are there any other comments? Abby, do you want
or nominations? Yeah. Right, for anybody else?
Yeah, that's
a recommendation, not a mandate.
True. Touche. Thank you. Abby, do you want to add anything?
No, I'm completely honored that the nominating committee put my name forward to do this. I wholeheartedly believe in economic development in the Wasatch Front, and happy to be a part of this. We're on the right track, and I think we can do some great things over the course of the next little bit. So, absolutely. Thanks, Chris.
And just so we're clear, I was not suggesting that that was not a good move. Obviously, I did it before, if you hadn't already. So, she saw it. We'll be in good hands.
But in all fairness, so we do have a nomination, and it's seconded. Do we have any other nominations? Yeah, welcome. Any other nominations? Well, hearing and seeing none, then the chair will close the nominations. And all those in favor of Abby becoming our chair, please indicate with an aye.
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 Any opposed? Excellent. Well, it's unanimous. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to it. Okay, well, over to you, Madam Chair.
Oh, goodness. We're going to do this right away. Okay, perfect. So fifth item on the agenda is the objectives review and the adoption of the WFEDD annual objectives. You have those in front of you, and now Scott has put those on the screen. As you recall, in last month's meeting, October, November, we went through these. We actually added the fourth one, put a little more meat on the bone on the third one, and had a robust discussion in both the Regional Growth Committee and the whole board of Wasatch Front on these objectives over the course of the last little bit.
Yeah, these objectives haven't actually had discussion by the council, but our thought is after you all look at them and finalize them, then we'll talk about them with the full council at our council meeting on the 25th of this month, so that they are all clear on the direction we're headed. Some of you are on the council, so yeah, that would be the path forward.
And I'll turn the time over to Scott here for a minute to give us a little more detail.
Okay, well, thank you very much. I do just want to really thank Commissioner Milne for his time and your focus on economic development in the area and Tula specifically and the work we've done out there. But really, I just think that we should give Commissioner Milne. So on the annual objectives, a couple of changes. We changed them from goals to objectives. We use the word goals a lot, but that was one recommendation. And then the one piece before, we don't have a whole lot of discussion on these, but number four. So Tina, you had made a recommendation that we do some education and outreach, and thinking about the right wording, and we don't need to get too into wordsmithing, but this number four, inform state, regional, and local stakeholders about economic development plans and strategies, I felt like is a good area within the goals to provide an outlet for education. I don't think that us, you know, we look to you for education as staff. I mean, I look to all of you as experts in your fields and areas, so we may be educating you, but I think what we would really do is provide this as a sounding board, a location to come and learn about new efforts and things that are coming out, and that's part of, you know, today's presentation on foreign trade zones, providing an opportunity for you to hear about something in the area, in the region that you might not be totally familiar with. So I hope that got to what you were looking for. If you want to provide some wordsmith or changes, we'd love to hear that and have any other discussion, and then hopefully move forward with these as our annual objectives to provide context for the agendas for the remainder of the year.
Well, just to follow up on that, my concern has always been as we switch the elected officials part of this, I think we've found that you just get everybody who sits on a committee has got an elected official will tell you a story about how they lost their position based on something that they were supporting economic development wise. And just as soon as you get someone on this committee up to speed over this is the overall plan, this is the goal for our community, we support that in a particular project and we come back and we lose our positions for that and we start all over again. So the idea is if we have a good plan, we should be getting that plan out to the community, communities that we serve, and this is the goal and the why, so that the projects that are coming along behind it make sense as well. So I will let everybody else in the room decide if that goal does it, because it's not just an education of us and as regional stakeholders and elected officials, but also the public in understanding these are the challenges that we're facing in a growing community.
how do we address those in a positive manner so everybody's quality of life goes up?
There's a program that I've worked out with us in an action center to do broadcast directly to all the schools. Right? So high school, middle school, junior high school, just into that entire population, including the leading innovators in specific spaces. So every STEM area you can think of, entrepreneurship, civic engagement, as well as sort of creativity and learning. And, you know, we're very, very high profile. To give you a sense, one of the third round conversations we had in fourth round tomorrow morning, actually, with James Cameron. And so I think I love these goals that we have. I would love to find a way to weave this into that message. Right? And that would be a very broad hit because of the numbers to about 300,000 students as like the primary audience. And then secondary is all these administrators and all schools that come to do that broadcast. We are broadcasting from their headquarters, so they don't come over here to do the annual holiday. They come here and be tied with a private session also. And so to take something like that and leverage it to promote these goals, I think would be great.
Joseph, you came in after we did introductions. Can you just, we have a few new members of the committee. Will you just introduce yourselves?
I don't know quite what to say.
Well, who you're with, you just.
Joseph Spence. Originally when I joined, I was with Goldman Sachs at the time. And so I headed the technology media telecom and real estate media lobbying business for Americas in the MENA region. I have since left Goldman and have one more month before I can launch my own firm, essentially. So I will be doing that. And so some of these are parts of that effort as well. So more to come on how I'm with currently, but for now, just myself.
Okay, perfect. Wonderful. Scott, do you want to walk us through kind of some the 50,000 foot view of each one of these goals so we all recall how we got here?
Yes. So. The goals will keep us on track with making sure that the agendas are worthwhile, that they're coming and bringing content to you that's moving the needle on economic development. So number one, this is our year for completion, adoption, and reporting back on the 2018 to 2023 five-year comprehensive economic development strategy. So completion is the end of May 2019, and then we'll have a six-month report due at the end of the year. Number two, this is also the year that we will be adopting and finalizing the Wasatch Choice 2050 long-range vision, as well as the 2019 to 2023 regional transportation plan. So looking at the coordination between economic development and Wasatch Choice 2050 and the elements of our long-range plan that promote economic development, coordinated growth, and quality of life in the region. And then number three gets to a place that we noted as an area in local government and even in state and regional government where conversations were being missed. And that's both that the economic development folks not speaking to maybe the planning and engineering side, and the planning and engineering side not realizing or speaking to how their decisions impact economic development. So one area that the WFEDD could be really helpful in coordinating is to integrate state, regional, local transportation decisions with economic development efforts to improve access between workforce housing and jobs. So getting to the answer that the location, the where, matters, and that's what Wasatch Choice 2050, our long-range transportation plan, hopes to answer, is that the location of jobs, the location of housing, its accessibility, location to transportation is just as important as the job itself or the number of jobs or the new growth in our region, especially in a constrained environment. So trying to work better to answer that location or where matters question is going to be key. And then adding to that, the item number four, to provide this as a board to help inform and educate on all sorts of state, regional, and local economic development efforts.
Do we have any questions about the four objectives?
And then to Mr. Spence, to your comment, so these are the objectives, and then we've actually created a document, and we're working through it, that's roles and responsibilities for the WFPDD, our partner communities, local communities, and staff on how they interact with each of these goals that we're gonna bring back to you, so that this is more than just an objectives, it's an action plan of how we move these forward. So I think that your discussion about STEM inclusion and how we get these goals going into the education system would fall within one of those roles and responsibilities.
Any further discussion? I guess I'll just add some commentary here. This is, you know, when you think about growth and everything that we're experiencing in every one of your communities, this, these three, there are these four objectives. And certainly, you know, the addition of number four, where we're just informing, and we're going to hear a little bit about it, one of those today, about the foreign trade zone. But, you know, this is, these three objectives really help us tackle the growth that we're experiencing and we will experience to make sure we're planning and developing and utilizing our finite amount of land in the most efficient and effective way. So I kudos to you for all of you that have been through the process of adopting these four goals. And I'll look for a motion to approve these four objectives and move them forward.
So moved.
Sean?
Yes.
Do we have a second?
Second.
Any discussion to the motion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Wonderful. Look at that, we got the objectives. We did
it.
Perfect. Okay, number six is the report from Zion's Public Finance. So Benj, you're here to give us a report on the SEDS reports and everything that you guys have been through over the course of the last few months of all the data. So
okay.
I'll turn the time to you. Is this a live mic here?
It is.
Okay.
Are you gonna give a brief? Yeah, can I give just a brief?
Absolutely.
All right, so just a brief introduction on this to make good on our promise. Objective number one, complete the SEDS. So here we are to work on that. We've got a little bit of background on this. Our SEDS would have been completed September of 2018. We had a consultant on board. We opted as a group to take a step back and revise the information that was coming out of that. And we asked for an extension from EDA, which was granted, to align our comprehensive economic development strategy with the adoption of a regional transportation plan and our regional vision. So for the Denver area that our Denver EDA offices cover, they were really excited about this opportunity. It gives us a unique chance to take the goals and outcomes and all of the really big press and forward push that we do on Wasatch Choice 2050 and roll all of the economic development strategies into that. So we're gonna be able to ride a wave on the approval of the SEDS this year that we wouldn't have been able to, a flag that we couldn't have flown last year. So that's one benefit. And then also just the direct alignment of our goals that come out of the SEDS and the long range transportation plan and vision are gonna really give our region, I think, a leg up in aligning the land use to transportation question and how we impact economic development. So the number one piece of this, you all as a group, about a year ago, did a strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, threats analysis. We have that data, we're revising it, and we'll come back out to you, but then the strategies and objectives for the comprehensive economic development strategy should be data driven. So we've got Zions Public Finance on contract to provide us with the background data. And Benj and I have had an opportunity to meet on this and really looking forward to the data that's coming out and also the story that the data is telling. So I would encourage you to, you know, think of your questions and let's have a conversation around this data, because this is going to be the baseline for what we create, the strategies, and then ultimately the objectives for the SEDS out of.
Great. Jump a little quick.
Yep, you're good.
Thanks, Scott. It's been great working with Scott. He's been really fun to work with. We've been working on gathering this data for about 2 months, and our job was really to put it together in an Excel spreadsheet. And so a lot of what you're going to see here is initial data in fairly raw format, but ultimately data so that WFRC could take it and put it into the graphs in the format that it ultimately needs. So I've taken the highlights out of the Excel spreadsheet and put them here and created some key points that I think are important, at least the story that the data is telling us. It was very important in this process for us that all of the data is from very verifiable sources. Most of the slides here, you'll see the source for it. If it's not sourced there, it's the spreadsheet that we have, everything is very heavily sourced from not from your second-rate internet sources, but really from the census, from the Gardner Institute, from reliable data sources. So we're going to go over just the basics of looking at population, employment, households, ages, household incomes, household costs, housing values, and commute patterns and times. Again, it's a lot of data, so we're just going to show you here. It's numbers here. This is the exciting part of the spreadsheet that you can take home and look over with your spouse or whatever. But here, what the point of the data here is to show 5 years up to 2023 of the data, and then also show it out through 2030, 2040, up to 2060. This just shows the change in population during those time periods. And it's just interesting to see that, you know, some key points here that we'll go over on the next couple of slides. Hopefully everybody brought their glasses, but for the most part, this is just to show you that this is the data, these are the sources where the key points and some of the tracking measures or recommendations are brought from. So a few key points. Growth in Morgan and Tooele County are at 1.9% per year, which is above the statewide average, 1.7%. The other three counties are below the statewide average. Roughly 11,670 new residents per year in Salt Lake County, which is about 20% of the total statewide growth. Just to put this in historical context, to understand those numbers, and when we go back here, just in this column here, you can see Davis County at 1.1%. Here are the five counties together at 1.1%. So Davis and Weber County are right there in line with the overall five county, but they're well below the state growth. You can see Salt Lake County is lower than statewide projected growth. But if you look at it in historical context, here's just interesting to me, Utah County growth, you can see how it grew per year. Those numbers, you got, you know, as high as 4.7 in the 70s. You look at Summit County, just as another perspective to see how it grew per year. So those growth rates that are projected for the five counties are obviously not significant in terms of what the state has experienced in other places historically. And just because I thought this was interesting, at the bottom there, Saratoga Springs, you can see their growth rate. That's what happens when you have a lot of vacant land. Employment. So then we really focused on employment. There's quite a bit here on employment as a real driver of what happens in the five county area. So again, looking at plan employment growth for the next 5 years, and then for the decades 2030, 40, 50, and 60, that percent change during that 40 years, that growth per year, the total new jobs, and what percentage that is of the total overall state. If you remember, Salt Lake County's total population growth was 20% of the state, but the job growth is 33%. As you can see, Morgan and Tooele counties, Weber County, you know, pretty nominal growth as compared to as percentages of the overall state. Davis County there at 8.8%. Interesting to me, and we'll digest this information a little bit later here, about the new jobs per year and what ultimately that will equate to in land needs, building needs, parking. I found that part to be, at least for me, somewhat fascinating.
Ben, can you go back for 1 second?
Yeah.
So if I may make a point here. These are projections which have a lot of assumptions that are built into them. So I want to say two things. One, the work that Wasatch Front Regional Council, sort of on the other side of the house here, does is looking at where growth can occur, but not just where there are projections for it to occur, but what the communities want to have happen. And that means that we don't design our transportation systems for the future with our partners at UDOT and UTA and the cities and counties just to say, this is fixed, this is guaranteed to happen, and let's build to that. We look at this and all of the local communities have the opportunity to say, what do we want to have happen in the future? And then we have the ability to bend the curve with the decisions we make on infrastructure, et cetera. So I'll just point out, for example, Weber County, 29% job growth below the other counties. Now that's based on certain assumptions, but that doesn't mean that is a fait accompli.
Sure.
The decisions that are made around housing and infrastructure and other decisions can have an impact on that. And it also doesn't need to be a zero-sum game. If Weber grows faster in jobs, that doesn't necessarily mean that Davis or Morgan or Salt Lake comes down. We can increase the overall pie. So this provides kind of a baseline for us to then make decisions about how to shape the curve going forward.
Great, thanks for explaining that. And that's part of some of the observations that we make here are this data in its current format, what it's telling us, what are the key points, what needs to be planned for in the future in terms to understand this data. And certainly, there are influences to this that are not felt here. There's the inland port, there are opportunity zones, the Olympics. I mean, all sorts of events and things that could happen in order to significantly change these numbers. And we get to that here in a minute. This was just out of interest here, unemployment rates. Always good to understand where counties rank in comparison to each other. As you can see, the five-county region has consistently been below the United States, and still all the counties are near. The state of Utah number are only nominally above or below in terms of unemployment rates. So I think we can skip over that. So a couple of key points, 11,300 jobs per year in Salt Lake County. The employment growth, but taking in mind what Andrew said about Weber County and Tooele County, is notably forecast to lag the state, at least based off of the current projections. This to me is somewhat interesting. So we took the numbers, the population employment ratio, and this is simply for the every increase in residents, or how many residents are added to an area, what is the corresponding increase in employment that's forecast. It's not a correlation there, but it's a forecast made by these same survey sources. So what you're saying there in Tooele County, that for every three persons increase in the population, you need one job. You can see what that says about Salt Lake County there, that you're almost looking at, for every increase in population, you're also looking at a corresponding increase in jobs. How that compares to the state, it's almost one and a half. Sort of interesting there. It's interesting to wonder why it is that Tooele's numbers continue to suggest more residents than job growth. You could certainly look into the aging demographic. Go ahead, Andrew.
I'm interested in this data, of course. But so one of the things that seems to jump out here also is on this ratio, if Tooele County, for example, is adding three people per job, then that has a direct impact on the commuting patterns, right? So folks, if you're adding a lot of people in Tooele City, but many more people than jobs, then you're presumably people are then commuting in to the Wasatch Front, which has a direct impact on the transportation system needs. And so trying to coordinate where people live, where the jobs are, is gonna be really important also for the infrastructure needs that we have going forward.
Andrew, to that point too, it also works in the reverse. If we don't solve some of those transportation infrastructure issues, we are going to get that.
Yeah.
Well, at best.
I'd say too, if you're gonna go three times to the 1.6 state average, you're gonna need housing for those people to come to the Tooele Valley, mm-hmm. which you don't currently have.
That's correct. Yeah.
Well, and I know I'm preaching to the choir with you and Chris and Mayor Wynn and Tina from a radio show she and I did this weekend, but as I looked at Gage Froer and others that know how the house works, if we don't address that, like, that's a problem long term for our economic development in the state too.
Yeah.
Because if we don't have affordable places for the workers, then GOED and EDC Utah are going to have a heck of a time going out and recruiting, or even seeing organic growth from our Utah companies. Because if they, unless they, have an overabundance of jobs that pay a much higher salary than they do right now, folks aren't gonna be able to afford it to be our workers. Then we're gonna see those workers flee, and we'll end up in a bust cycle of our boom and bust for economic growth. So there's gotta be, I know this is getting off topic, but it's relevant with what we're asking Bench to do with the SEDS. Because like we have 9 referendums right now in Tooele Valley for residential rezones. Because people think that kind of growth belongs in the metro area, but then they want local leaders to create more local jobs. Mm-hmm. And if those jobs don't have the corresponding housing, then we gotta do something. Nobody wants to override popular vote and sentiments by our public that we're there to serve.
but there's got to be an education component. So anyway, it all comes together. It's not in a silo anymore.
Ted, you want to?
Yeah, thank you. So look at the number 2060 in the blue on the far right. That's 1.4. So part of the question is, how does a county, does it start to move to 1.4, or does it start to move away from 1.4? And so Davis and Morgan, Davis moves closer to 1.4, Morgan doesn't, Salt Lake doesn't, Tooele doesn't, and Weber County doesn't. And here is my main point, that when the Gardner Policy Institute does this work, they look also at land policy. So they look at what planning is happening in each county. And so it's there. There's a composite message of what does the economy want to do, and then what does land planning allow and encourage? And this is basically it's a call to arms. This is a call to arms that if counties exclusive of Davis, which is apparently sort of welcoming more economic development and moving closer to the median, that the rest of the counties, there's an opportunity here where Salt Lake County could welcome more housing and the other counties could welcome more jobs so that they become more self-reliant. Does that make sense? I just wanted to note that when Gardner Policy Institute does this projection, they look at planning. Mm-hmm. Now, the planning that is in place, which is not the same as the vision, which is the direction of where we could go. And I think it highlights there is a gap between the planning that's in place and the vision that we can achieve, which helps counties become more self-reliant.
Great comment. Thank you. Let's go to the next one.
Actually, Ted, you and I think very much alike looking at the data. I see this as an opportunity to control growth. I see it an opportunity for economic development. I see it simply says if we sit back and just simply watch it happen, this is indicative of what we'll see. But if we look at this as basically a forecast that we can actually drive an outcome that's different than what we see, then I think the counties, much like Weber County, Gage, has a real opportunity, in Morgan County, for an example, have an opportunity to take control of this and simply influence the future. Because as it sits right now, the behavior, the information says this is what we can expect unless we make change. So let's change it. And if the best answer to this question is to enhance this, to bring more economical opportunities in the case of Weber County, maybe I can take less dependency on the infrastructure moving our people from Weber County to Salt Lake County for jobs. And we can invest more money in terms of our infrastructure out there. So I see some opportunities here, Ted, your point. We can use this as a map to basically start to drive a behavior that's going to put the economic development where we want it, not allow it just to simply happen.
Let's note before you jump in, Joseph, that is exactly number three, Mayor. Yeah. So thank you for saying that. But we'll keep referencing back to the objectives to make sure we're hitting on those. So great point, Joseph.
Just one minor point to amplify what I just heard. You know, the next 5 to 10 years, and I can tell you more, 5 years, we'll see new technologies come on board that will be incredibly transformative. And this was my piece that I did the last 20 years. Right? Communication technologies, 5G, mobility technologies, all of which that can be leveraged, you know, very effectively to solve a lot of these things. And the place that most people kind of look at Utah being somewhat small as a disadvantage, the reality is in many ways it's an advantage being the size that it is, because you have the ability to get a greater consensus here than you would in a place like New York City. Potentially, it's a lot of work, obviously, to do it. But looking at external parties that would be interested in investing in a lot of these types of technologies, the advantage, that's actually an advantage for Utah, is really around the ability to get consensus and coordination rights. But the investment dollars, the technology being made available are all there, both from the larger technology companies as well as a lot of the sovereign wealth funds. And so it's really a matter of really understanding how a technology story weaves through a lot of these challenges that we're looking at, and putting together a very turnkey platform opportunity for a lot of these players. And you would see, you know, those dollars and those opportunities rolling very quickly.
So Scott will go to you for the final.
Yeah, so I just wanted, so it says a lot about this group to put up a spreadsheet and then have a really good conversation around it, just how interested you are. But we'll take the data from this, will drive directly those goals. So if you look at, we had 6 goals in the last set. One of them was attract businesses that offer higher wages. Another was retain and expand existing businesses. And what you can begin to do with the objectives is drive retention to those counties that are already hitting numbers like this, drive, expand new business opportunities to those counties that are seeing numbers that are diverging from the state averages, and really help us make sure that over the next 5 years we have an actionable set. So I appreciate everybody's comments and really looking forward to having that strategy, the strategies and objectives conversation with you, because it's just going to be one for one from straight out of the data, what the data is telling us.
Okay. Moving on, I'm sure you can all read that. This is just the breakdown of the 5-county area for the projected job growth in the different job categories. So you can see anything from agriculture to other services, military, what it's projected for the next 5 years, and then what it does all the way to 2060. Total increase in number of jobs projected and the percent change. Where I found this was interesting is that we took it and then just put it in order of, total job increase for 2020 to 2060 to understand the sectors that are anticipated to have the most growth. And then in the yellow there, you can see those that are projected to have some negative activity there. Construction, well, let's actually go here. Some key points that construction gains are largely dependent upon economic health. It is a widely swaying job category depending on our economy. Don't get caught up in administrative and waste services. Just focus on administrative services. Why are they labeled the waste services in there? It's a small component of that. I had to go look up the code to make sure. Oh, a lot of garbage.
Thanks, codes, fun stuff.
Yes. Construction gains do not adequately consider major infrastructure projects for the region. So this would be Point of the Mountain, Inland Port, major transportation infrastructure. Losses in transportation and warehousing, initially, this stuck out to me at 12,000. Why the loss? We're obviously dealing with an economy now that is very much based on distribution and logistics, same day type shipping. Scott and I had a good conversation about this, and this is, it's really to automated services. So I think Scott toured a port in Oakland,
LA,
recently, and it's, hundreds of acres and the cranes moving everywhere, and what, three or four people that are operating the cranes, and so it's massive automation. So that is a sector that what should be a consideration as we're going forth with the inland port, which will see a lot of distribution, logistics, sort of some, it also have some production manufacturing influences that are significant. But to know that that sector is forecast to see some job losses. POM, Point of the Mountain jobs are largely grouped right now into the professional and technical services. And obviously, Salt Lake County should be capturing quite a bit of that. Utah County will as well, obviously. And then again, this does not consider some major influences, some of those that we mentioned.
Ben, quick question. As we develop the sense, could we compare those increases to the percentage change in population? In other words, a number of 50,000, well, what does that actually mean compared to the size of the region?
Sure.
Will you write that?
I think Susie's taking some notes, is that right?
That's good.
Okay.
Awesome. So here's the same graph, and this now, this became intriguing to me. I took potential square feet per employee. Now, everything up to this point has been very verified data. This column right here, there is some subjectivity to this, just to be honest. This is from ULI, from IREM, from several real estate organizations. There's not a consensus on these numbers, as you can imagine, because it differs wildly from year to year, from industry to industry. But I took what we typically use as IONS, what IREM and ULI support, and you can see the potential square feet per employee. This right now, this professional technical services, if we were in the Bay Area, this is closer now to 150 square feet. We're a little bit different here. And what this would be, total square foot needs over that 40-year period. And what does this all mean for land needs? This is kind of an interesting study to say how much land would be needed if we were to really have 97,000 professional and technical services jobs. Well, if you look at for the 40 years, again, total square feet, that's including the losses there that we get from that transportation. Now, again, there are a few here, just in all honesty, that I don't know what to put, that nobody really knows what to put on farm, utilities, military, mining. Their square feet per employee is a difficult number. Construction's a very difficult number. You know, sometimes, you know, construction has offices that they do, but this could be wildly different. So again, there's subjectivity to this. Probably should use more rounded numbers, but I thought you'd just think it was interesting. 3 million square feet per year, if you were to look at it, different floor area ratios. 0.2 is usually what you get with most retail property, suburban retail. 0.3 gets you a little bit more, sorry, Ted's laughing at me.
I'm not laughing, you're right. It's amazing how low that number is, but it's, never mind. So it's another conversation.
0.3, 0.4, so how many acres you would need per year for the 5-county area if you were to have that type of job growth. Then this ultimately amounts to 150 square feet per new resident, which overall, that number is a little bit low. Typically when we think of new residents, we think somewhere in the range of 200 to 220 square feet with a combination of retail office space. So this number seems right to me once you consider some other additions. But anyways, I thought that was somewhat interesting. Then this was intriguing to me. If you take the new jobs per year for each of the counties, and then in an average, we're about 350 square feet per parking space. This is beyond.
Sorry. You're going just a little too fast. So probably just for me. Everybody else is totally right with you, I'm sure. So what does this tell you? I mean, in terms of the available land that exists, you're just giving us the needs and then it is next step to compare to availability? Or
so I'm 6 weeks into pulling data, and our data is to give you a Excel spreadsheet that has all this data. This really is taking it another step and saying, hey, I can tell you what the population employment growth is, but here's what it means realistically to a land planner of these 5-county areas, is that we may have to figure out where 345 acres per year needs to be planned if we keep going along at these floor area ratios that we are using now. And most stuff that you're going to find in the 5-county area outside of downtown Salt Lake and downtown Sandy and is going to be in this 0.2 or 0.3. So you're going to need as a land planner to figure out almost 300 acres per year of commercial space. This is not residential. This is just commercial space.
Now, so if we were to just develop on the available land, Greenfield, we don't have enough. But a really smart guy tuned down for me said in a video that I just watched the other day that we don't necessarily need the available land to continue to develop in this way. We have an opportunity to go up. Just like every other metro area that has been successful has continued to rise. And so let's not be afraid of this as we're looking at these numbers that we don't have enough greenfield land available. We just have to be strategic vertically.
This should I advocate.
Wait, can I pause there? Jeff has a comment.
And commercial construction.
And also infill and redevelopment.
Yeah.
Right, well, redevelopment's our favorite subject. That strikes fear and trembling into the hearts of every elected official that there is on the planet. But we want to convert all of our green space into other things.
That's what I was just about to chime in on. So most of those referendums that we're having in Tooele Valley are because folks are recognizing that they need to transition from an agricultural-based setting, right, or a ranchette, a 5-acre ranchette. And there's been a lot of talk in the last decade about urban farming, right? Even if you just want to get trendy and catchphrase concentrated, but this is a Western thing that I don't know how you avoid it. As I've tried to talk to our citizens, it's just the human way that we take up good agricultural land and we build cities and parking lots on it, right? But if we want to shift it, I'm not saying that this middle-aged guy in Illinois, Utah's got the solution here, but we need to shift our mindset that if we want to save, as Jeff just said, green space, even if it's just parks and rec, kind of quality of life elements, or if it's the food production closer to home, to Chris's point about, we talked about commutership. If you've got a bunch of, bedroom communities over here, and you got the job centers over there, we've got this community thing. But the same thing goes for beef production or anything else. that we've got, we should incentivize residential, particularly to go vertical. Not that I want to give up my Kentucky bluegrass, but you know, that's the mentality that we all suffer against. Like, everybody else wants everybody else to use mass transit, but we want to drive separately. Everybody else wants folks to be in this density. But certainly, like, I think this is where the Housing Gap Coalition has an opportunity here in this educational mindset to shift our thoughts, because otherwise, to your point, Abby, we don't have 350 acres per year for just greenfield. So it's the redevelopment, which takes it from a scenario that my family and Sandy retail against right now. They don't like all the vertical buildings, some of these family members are telling me. And I'm like, well, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, I would love to have some of what you have in Sandy in my community in Tooele, because my citizens go and leave their tax dollars in your community, enriching you to be able to steal the Hale Center Theater from West Valley, enable you to have a successful mall, and I don't get any of those things. And then my citizens come home, ask why we as leaders can't provide them splash pads and greater per capita police agency, you know, employees and stuff like that. So again, it's a much broader conversation, but I think what this group has realized in the last couple of years particularly is no longer are these things in a silo. Mm-hmm. And I love the way that you're presenting the data, Benj, and I'm glad that we revisited how to do the sets a little bit differently than we were considering before, because this is so topical.
Mm-hmm. And I'm not meaning to try to fly through. I know there's a group, there's another great presentation. I think I'm out of my time, but I have a few more slides here quickly for you.
So this
has been great in that Scott really understands that travel considerations need to be based on economic realities. And so this, hold together, this is the new jobs per year based off Gardner Institute data. Needed parking square feet per year. So it's simply just taking 350 square feet per parking space. And you're assuming here, am I off there, Ted? I mean, it's 322.
No.
I'm sorry, I thought you were giving a discouraging look.
I was looking at Ted quizzically because it depends on where the job is. And if that's an average, right? So it all depends on it's not just vertical or more centered development on residential. It can be vertical, more centered development on commercial or retail, coordinated with transportation. So it depends. So, but keep
sure. So anyway, just the point here is that for every new job, you're most likely are going to have somebody who has a vehicle or needs to get to that job. Ideally, it's through transit, so you don't need these parking spaces. But the point here is to paint the picture to say, if we don't consider the impacts of economic realities and employment growth on transportation models, which I know you do, we there's obviously a parking consideration here that you would need in Davis County 24 almost acres a year. Over a 40-year period, 950 acres of land just to satisfy the parking that's associated with the jobs. So I'm not saying this is the reality here. I'm saying this is what, just something to consider. 5,000 acres in the next 40 years in the five-county area that would need to be dedicated simply to parking if it's one parking space for each of these jobs. That's 8 square miles. It's bigger than Centerville, bigger than Wendover, Utah portion, bigger than Roy. It's in there with Taylorsville, Mill Creek, and it's larger than Mountain Green. Just to get an understanding so that it needs to be a focus, in my opinion, of sets it. How are we going to attack the parking issue, connecting people? We have to make sure that these developments, that these 89 acres that are being put into Morgan County, are they accessible? Anyways, there's more impact than that. We'll fly through this. This is just total household growth. And the persons per household, there's some interesting information here. Declining household sizes for all counties and for statewide figures. Greatest change in household sizes will be in Morgan and Tooele counties, and about 10,000 households to be needed per year for the five county area. That's households, remember. What's that?
We are already behind.
Already behind.
So.
Here's just this kind of summarizes a little bit of that. The average household size, if you look at, this is over the 40 years. This is considering the decline that's anticipated to happen in average household sizes. So this is a 40-year average here for the different counties. That's the number of households needed per year for each area. As Abby says, we are already behind this, even though this is an average that's considering the next 40 years. So we're behind that already. Here's the state of Utah. If you're looking at 15,000 square foot lots, So if you're West Haven and Syracuse and you're sticking to this, for 10,000 square foot lots, 5,000, 1,500 square foot lots, maybe more, you know, the range of apartments, the number of acres that you would need for residential space to accommodate this type of housing. This does not include roads and parks. So this is underestimating it. So you probably want to put almost 30%, depending on the development, so single family development, 30% onto this, on these 15,000, 10,000 square foot lots, just in land needs that you would have to accommodate that population. So that, again, this is the reason for another argument for vertical construction. Some key points here, the shrinking household sizes for the five county area should be a major consideration going forward for typical housing sizes. If we needed 2,200 square feet before, maybe in 2030, 2040, it's 1,800 square feet. It should be a consideration that developers, builders, planners, cities are actively considering. It should be consideration and projections for schooling based on households, service impact, which I know that it is.
And Benj, can I just, on that note, so this is, so I come from an urban planning city planner background, and this is how I wanted to connect the dots between transportation,
right,
land use planning, and economic development, is to say that things like an accessory dwelling units ordinance in a location where you could effectively double population in place or double units in place without going vertical, without increasing surface parking, without really doing anything other than letting your sister-in-law, whoever, live in your basement, are economic development strategies that are going to impact the ability to put people in places where there are existing jobs, where you want to grow the number of jobs. So I think that this is relevant on, you know, Chamber's efforts. It's going to be relevant at school district efforts. Like, I hope that everybody sees the relevancy of these types of numbers and how it's going to better our SEDs, better impact economic development. So I, all these connections, I just love it. I love your drawing.
Great. Ages, you know, here just is the decline or the increase in ages, very similar to the state. You can see, though, in the observations here, that Tooele and Morgan County are going to have a greater percentage change in age than you would for the five county area and for the overall state. Just a consideration in making, you know, plans for services. Median household incomes, here you are, you can see what the incomes are at the threshold levels. I'm going to fly through this, just I think you're probably pretty aware of this information. Housing costs, this is from the Census Bureau and the their updated survey sources. The cost of owner housing, owner versus rental cost, what's the difference there? The difference in state and owner average. You know, there's some things that certainly stick out as to why it is that Weber County's owner housing and rental, or excuse me, the difference, why they're so much different than the state averages, why they have lower costs than the state in terms of rental.
Called Ogden City.
What's that?
It's called Ogden City.
Ogden City. So, anyway, I think important things in planning, making housing decisions going forward, knowing that maybe we don't have an affordability crisis in some of these areas, where other areas we certainly do have an affordability crisis.
Is that, Commissioner, because Ogden represents a bigger share of Weber County's housing than, let's say, Salt Lake West Valley would have a similar impact on Salt Lake County, but as a share of the population, it's a smaller share. So Ogden has a bigger impact on Weber's average numbers, right?
Absolutely. If you look at the housing units in Ogden City proper compared to every place else in Weber County, that causes. And if you look at the number of rental units, especially if you're comparing rental units, because that's a majority of our rental stock as well.
Yeah.
That's the reason you're seeing. Not that that's something we're proud of, but that's the fact.
Just turn your attention to this average right here on a couple of these slides. This average that has the asterisks, this is an average simply of these five numbers. It's not an average of the total households in that area. So to me, this becomes a slightly skewed number because you're heavily influencing areas of lower population or higher population. If you're looking at total households, it'd be very similar to, you know, probably the Salt Lake County metric, which it actually happens to be. What do household costs mean for the region? So there's some important tracking issues here. Does an increase in housing, this is something you could track from the said study, does an increase in housing or employment result in changes to the difference in monthly housing costs for the counties when compared to the state, how impactful to the ratios are major new job centers. Here's a look at median property values, the difference they are with the state. Keep cruising here. Important tracking metrics here. What's the percent difference in counties and the state in future years? It's obviously something that's easy to track. If this number is increasing or decreasing, the relationship of the median property value to the state, is it due to an increase in jobs? Is it more housing stock? Is it both? Is it just other economic pressures? I mean, something that can be tracked in order to have benchmarks to make SEDs more applicable. This is the housing income ratio. I always find this interesting. This is the cost of a house compared to average household income. So if your house is, you know, Davis County is 3.4 times greater than your income, you can see what it is for, oops, all the other counties, how it compares to the state. Salt Lake County is notably higher than the state and suggests, you know, some affordability issues, which obviously we've been hearing about for quite some time. As some important tracking issues here, as the more populated counties become built out, what is happening to the housing income ratios? Are incoming jobs to these respective counties, are they producing wages that influence the ratio, or are these jobs simply pushing housing values higher? Is that ratio staying the same? Because as the increase in incomes, as you're seeing increases, significant increases in housing prices, are ratios progressing at a constant rate in comparison to the state, or are certain areas seeing greater divides due to employment growth or stagnation based on new housing developments? Sorry, so here's historical. I thought it was important just to know where this is trending. Davis County, what's happening here, Tooele County, what's happening, State of Utah, and then our competitors, or competitors at least in terms of the job market, right? So if you're considering relocating to Portland, you've got to convince your employees that they need to have five times, I mean, there's a difference here between Portland and Tooele County. And then my lovely home of San Francisco that I moved from 5 years ago for an obvious reason here. I only put that because it's not a computer. But a lot of jobs are coming from the Bay Area to Utah. So, and to me, it's an interesting metric to know that while we do have an affordability issue and a growing issue, something that can be attacked, we are in a little bit still beneficial position marketing-wise compared to other areas.
What do I call it, Tina?
She's doing that because you gave hard questions.
Crisis on the cusp.
So are you projecting? Can you go back? You had it before, or can you? It's hard to project, but are you able to project forward? I mean, the presumption is that it's just going to get the we're going to deviate further between housing cost and income as if the trends continue, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think if in 2010 someone were to ask you that question, I don't think people would have picked these numbers here, because we would have thought at that time in 2010 that incomes would have increased at a greater rate. If you looked at this in 2012, housing values fell so much still from 2010 to 2012, or were still declining, that it's very subjective. You know, we've had some years in Salt Lake County where we've had 17% increases, which it's hard to forecast that, obviously. Okay. But yes, you can see this gap in every case here is increasing.
Yes.
Is that gap extrapolated to 2060, and if so, how did it influence the job growth?
Say that one more time.
Was that number extrapolated to 2060, numbers?
No.
So we don't know what the effect of that will be yet on the job growth that you have for 2016.
No, this is purely just 2010 current. No projected data here. This is all.
Tom, you have a question.
Yeah. Sorry, no, just to comment on that, I appreciate that slide, because what we hear from businesses all the time, affordability is relative. If you're in San Francisco, we talk to companies. Everyone from outside of Utah talks about how affordable Utah is. You talk to companies here, they talk about how it's getting so expensive. And it's really a mindset when you're dealing with people, because there's a lot of people from outside who say, Utah's still ridiculously affordable.
Sorry, I'm having trouble with the connection.
So I think as we look at growth is going to be coming from these places, because yeah. it's all a matter of where you start from, your expectation. Anything's going to be cheaper than San Francisco, New York, those are.
You know, Tom, that's an interesting, this is sidebar, but as we consider the political and cultural norms, if you're importing a bunch of folks from a place that culturally is not like yours, there's a whole different kind of societal pressure that I can see as elected leaders we're going to get, because I know I've been getting a lot of folks that have said, well, we don't want that kind of density, we don't want daybreak in Tooele Valley, we don't want Californians is another thing they'll specifically say.
I believe that they call them those
and yet
kind of people.
I'm actually already
don't want
one
those
of their
kind of people.
What's that?
We don't want those kind of people.
And they've actually been saying that at the microphone, which makes me wince. But therein is something else too, because that becomes a hard sell if those companies are testing the market, so to speak, and they'll do the secret shopper situation in our communities, and that's the kind of sentiment that they hear. Well, then that works against us too, because then those jobs aren't coming to match the housing increase, right?
And we're seeing that community to community right now, right? And I think that only increases or decreases depending on which community you are.
Well, I'm just going to put this grenade out in the middle of the room, too. But then you have the difference between the red or blue.
Right.
And what that does depending upon where the air imports are coming from and how communities might recoil on the changes there, too.
Okay, let's keep.
Last one, commute times. Here you go. Average commute times. Go on, you keep going, right? Average commute times, you can see who drove alone, carpooled, worked at home. The difference in the state average is really not as significantly different as maybe I thought you'd have for some of these counties. Obviously, this is something that's very easy to track and is a great tracking tool to figure out our new highways, is mass transit, is it making an impact on how people make decisions in these different counties? Morden and Tooele County have similar commute times with notably different behaviors towards carpooling. Interesting, I mean, in a planning sense going forward, it's certainly good to know that.
Hey, just stating the obvious, go back for 1 second. If in 20 years or 30 years, with all the population growth and all the job growth that we've been talking about, if 78% of people on the Wasatch Front are still driving alone, yeah. we are
toast.
We're toast. There's a good word. There's a word to the point that we won't have the economic development or the housing growth because the traffic congestion will be so bad.
We'll still have that air quality though.
Right, yeah. That it'll keep people out. So we've got to keep providing choices to people, not force anybody out of their cars, but give them good, viable choices to choose something different than driving alone.
Last slide, exactly that, is just how this can be tracked, is access to transit reducing commute times, or infrastructure improvements leading to reduced commutes, and hopefully that data proves helpful down the road for making some of these decisions.
Scott, can you give us an idea of what next? Because you're obviously not done, Benj, you guys have still got some work to do, so where we go?
So we'll collect this data. We're actually going to use it in conjunction with our projections for our Wasatch Choice 2050 vision. So there's especially the commute times data that we have. And then I plan to share this presentation out with the group. So there were a number of people who looked over and asked when you can get that data. So we will share it back out with the group if science is comfortable with that. And then also once we get the final data, which looks like this, just spreadsheets, we'll also share that information out as well. So thank you so much. We're really looking forward to it.
Thanks, Ben. Okay, quickly, Ben with the Salt Lake City is gonna talk to us about the foreign trade zone. And this kind of goes into our objective number four, informing. Oh, Ben is not here. Lisa is here. You are not a Ben.
He just got a lot better looking. Don't tell myself that.
That's good.
That's awesome. That's
okay, good. I'm going to start this off with Tom, but there's just some handouts, really quick, a brief overview of the foreign trade zone and a map on the back, and then my contact information is also included. Just to introduce myself as well, so I'm Liesl Lindberg. I'm with Salt Lake City. I've been with the Department of Economic Development for almost a year. I'll hit my mark next month. Before that, I was with the Department of Commerce as a graduate fellow, so I'm graduating with my MPP from the University of Utah in December. Go me. And how many of you have heard about foreign trade zones or know what they are? Yes. Okay. So we can run through this pretty quick. Maybe. Guys, I'm not good with technology.
Is it on the side?
I think so.
And point it over to that corner.
To the box. There. Okay, here we go. So currently there are about 300 operating FTZs in the United States and about 450 worldwide. Many countries have free trade zones. The point is to expedite and encourage foreign commerce. So sometimes they're referred to as free zones, specialized economic zones, export processing zones, or entry points. And they developed in the 1930s due to the Great Depression and the war. So the point was to increase foreign trade after the war, and then also to keep jobs in the United States. So there's an idea that you can make stuff in Germany for cheaper than you could in the US, which is harmful to US commerce. So they wanted to keep foreign trade or open up foreign trade zones here in order to keep manufacturing in the United States. Foreign trade zones are federally designated secure locations in the US, and they are considered to be outside of US commerce. So what happens is merchandise and goods that enter into a foreign trade zone, it's considered neutral territory, and they're treated as if they're outside of the United States. So they're not subject to duties and taxes at that point of entry. They're only subjected to them once they leave the foreign trade zone and enter the US market. And right now, we are operating under a foreign trade zone number 30. So we have a 60-mile radius around Salt Lake City, as we're the administrators. So it includes almost the entirety of the Wasatch Front. Our southernmost border for the foreign trade zone is Spanish Fork. So anything that's south of that is not included, and then anything that's north of Brigham City is also not included.
It's on the back side.
And it's on the back side as well. So it's a pretty extensive area, and we do have an option for municipalities that lie on the outskirts that aren't included in the 60-mile radius. So they can come and talk to me about that. But, so, who is the foreign trade zone for? We like to think that it's for companies within the 60-mile radius of Salt Lake City who import at least $1 million in goods. And we use that $1 million threshold because there is a cost associated with being a part of the FTZ. Typically, it's between $5,000 and $10,000 per year. And so with that fiscal impact, you also have to be making enough money to pay for the fees. And then usually you have a full-time employee that comes on, helps with the onboarding process, and also the customs requirements. So we also see that manufacturing and logistic companies are more likely to use the foreign trade zone. And I have a slide later on that kind of goes through what's permitted inside the zone. But it's just not typically a good fit for the service industry, since services are typically not exported products. You're exporting a good or a service to another individual, but it's not something that's handheld. So, like I said, we are a FTZ 30, which is the alternative site framework. So there's two different types of foreign trade zones that can be administered: the alternative site framework and the traditional site framework. We recently updated to the ASF in August of 2017. So this allows for faster processing times. Typically, once an application is placed with the Foreign Trade Zone Board, it takes about 3 months for the official process to occur and the decision to be made to allow a company to enter into a foreign trade zone. The traditional site framework, which we had before, it was like a 9-month process. So it's much faster, it's a way more simple to apply, and we also have a larger circumference, so that 60-mile radius, and we have more land that can be appropriated to foreign trade zone warehousing. So all good things. And then there's two different types of zones as well. So when there's already a foreign trade zone in use, right now we have one up in Ogden, Scott Sports is using the foreign trade zone, and then we also have one in Salt Lake, just over here, It's the Rockefeller Group. And so if a company was to link in with them, they would be considered a magnet site. So it's a little less expensive. It's about $5,000 at that point to be a part of the zone every year. When the zone goes to the user, so if there's nobody in the area for a company to connect with that's already using the foreign trade zone, it's where it becomes a little bit more expensive. It's about $10,000. So this is a fairly comprehensive list of activities that are permitted in an FTZ zone. And the ones to really focus on are the assembled and manufactured. So we have a lot of assembly and manufacturing that happens, especially within Salt Lake City, but Utah has a very robust manufacturing industry. And when you're manufacturing or doing assembled materials, whether it's like actually putting things together or repackaging, the goods that are brought in from places like China, they are duty-free until they leave and either go into U.S. commerce or go into global commerce. And then that usually drives down the cost of the duties and taxes that are paid by the companies.
So Lisa, this seems like this fits very nicely with what we're talking about for Northwest Quadrant and in
yes.
Newport. I don't know if you're going to get to that, but it jives with the whole concept around
it in Newport. It does. Absolutely. Right? So, in fact, with foreign trade zones, a lot of them you'll see work in conjunction with inland ports. A good example is California. They don't have an inland port, they actually have ports. You also have the Port Authority of Miami, and then South Carolina as well. Columbia, South Carolina has the BMW factory in their port, which they actually got BMW to come in, or their Port Authority did, because they were opening a foreign trade zone. So that's how they recruited BMW manufacturing out in that area. So it's a really good tool to bring up and talk to companies about who are looking into your area, that we have this potential for them to join the foreign trade zone. And I'll get into some of the financial benefits here in just a second. Right here. So, like I said, duty deferral takes place when the product is imported and being stored. There's duty elimination on exports that are going back out into global commerce. So if you are producing something here in Utah under Foreign Trade Zone 30 that is going to China or that is going to India, then you are not paying duty when that product leaves your foreign trade zone. You are only paying the duty when it goes back out into the US, like if you're shipping to California, Georgia, any of those places. There's also a duty reduction, or what we call an inverted tariff relief. So the tariff that's charged on the product that's leaving your warehouse, it's subject to the cheaper duty. So if you're importing something from China that, you know, the duty, let's say, is $3 on that, you're using it to produce a product like a remote, where when it goes back out into the U.S. commerce, it's $5 on this for duty, you're going to pay the $3. So if that makes sense, it's going to go with the less expensive duty rate. You also have duty reduction on scrap and waste. This one, the weekly entry, is something that I think goes kind of flies under the radar a little bit. So when companies are bringing in materials, they go through customs check, and once they clear customs, they're immediately sent to the company's warehouse. And every time you receive a shipment from customs, you have to pay for it. So weekly entry allows companies to go through and schedule when the shipments will come, and then they're only paying for that one shipment every time. So they're not paying for it as it comes in. Customs will hold the product for them until the scheduled shipment, and then they pay for all of that product at once. And that also helps them as well with the flow of product coming in and out of their warehouse. So the basic premise here is that import duties and federal excise tax are not paid until and unless the goods enter the commerce of the United States. There's a couple of other benefits. We see improved Customs and Border Patrol compliance. So these companies are less likely to get in trouble when they are importing goods and materials. There's lower security and insurance costs. There's shorter transit time if you're using direct delivery from another foreign trade zone. There's no time constraints on storage. So a lot of companies around Salt Lake have kind of expressed interest in this because They are nutraceutical companies who are using chemicals, and they can import as many chemicals as they want and store them as long as they're stored safely for as long as they want in their warehouse. Like I said, there's no time constraint. And then as well, the improved inventory control and production equipment. So there's a deferral on cost. So if you have a company like Caterpillar who's making tractors, a lot of their product comes in pieces. And so, or like the machines that they use to actually build their product comes in pieces and they can put them together and they're saving money there. So the federal government is pretty heavily involved in foreign trade zones, as it is a federal government program. And there's two primary agencies that regulate foreign trade zones. The first is the FTZ board, and it's run under the Department of Commerce. So they establish how FTZs are designated, modified, they approve production authority, and approve new zone activities. So any company within the foreign trade zone radius has to apply with the foreign trade zone board, and they are the ones that review the application and will go through and decide whether or not what that company plans to do within the borders is permitted. And then we have U.S. Customs, and they authorize activations and regulate the operation of the FTZ once it's activated. So, Salt Lake City, we are the grantee of the foreign trade zone, and really our job is to apply for grants of authority and decide the structure. So we were the ones that went to the Department of Commerce and said we would like to update from a traditional site work framework to a what we're under right now, the ASF. And then we implement and establish a zone schedule, so we determine the fees that are paid by companies looking to enter into the foreign trade zone. And then we do have the potential of operating our own zone site, which we have chosen not to. And so what we've done is we've delegated responsibility to companies. We are also responsible for executing and monitoring agreements with operators and property owners, and responsible for marketing the FTZ to attract companies to locate within the current zone, which is why I'm here. So my big play to you guys is what you can do to help us in promoting the foreign trade zone. I talk to a lot of companies on a daily basis who are either looking to come to Salt Lake City in particular, or who are already located in Salt Lake City, they're hoping to expand. And it's amazing how many of them don't even know or like comprehend that there is this thing called the foreign trade zone and what the financial benefits to their companies are. So for us, it's been a really great tool as far as retention goes with our efforts there, and also in getting companies to at least look into Salt Lake for relocation purposes. So we think from Salt Lake City that you guys would be able to target companies within your jurisdiction that import at least $1 million in foreign goods every year, and then pitch this idea to them. Let them know that there is the foreign trade zone that can help them reduce operating costs. You can schedule meetings with local businesses to discuss the foreign trade zone option. I'm more than happy to join on any meetings if you feel like you need someone who has a little bit more in-depth knowledge. You can engage Salt Lake City's FTZ contact, again, that's me, and then include foreign trade zone information in marketing materials and on your agency's website. And the handout that I passed out is what I take on my meetings or to my meetings with companies, and I'm more than happy to send you an electronic copy if you would like to post that on your website or to have it in your kind of swag bag of knowledge that you take out to companies. And then the other suggestion is participate in webinars that are hosted by the FTZ board and the National Association of Foreign Trade Zones. Typically they're free, they're very informative, they give a lot of use cases of different companies that have been able to utilize the FTZ, and then you can learn more about them. So this is my contact information, and again, it's there in front of you on the paper, and you're more than welcome to call me or email me with any questions or with any leads. The way that the process usually goes is if you have a company that's interested in joining the foreign trade zone, you can pass their contact information along to me. I can talk to them, or you know, we can just kind of do a little bit of a pass between. But we have a group of consultants that we will usually send a company to, and those consultants are able to give that company kind of back of the napkin cost estimate, and they do that for free. So they will tell that company whether or not the foreign trade zone is fiscally beneficial to their company. And like I said, they do it free of charge. They only start charging when we start going through the application process, because that's takes a little bit more manpower. So that's it for foreign trade zones. And anybody have any questions? I know it was a pretty quick presentation. So
that was great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. So this type of presentation we're gonna try to do on our quarterly meetings. We're after next time we're actually gonna have a discussion on the opportunity zones. Remember, we had 43 designated here in the state of Utah, 19 of which are in the Wasatch Front. So Patrick Mullen is going to come in and give us a report. This is probably the single biggest tax benefit for a business in a long, long time to end up in one of these opportunity zones. So it should be an interesting discussion. Okay, we have T-minus 1 minute. Anything that any of you want to bring up, want to discuss, now is your opportunity. And item number 8. Okay, seeing none. I have something that I have to read here, right? Verbatim. Okay. As most of you know, we practice compliance by showing a short video about Utah's Public and Open Meetings Act. Right now, I will take a motion and a second to adjourn the meeting. I would encourage you to stay for this video, but I know some of you have already received this training. It is an 11-minute video, so if you have to leave, we understand, and have some of the conversations outside of the room. But if we can get a motion and a second to adjourn the meeting.
Wait.
The one thing I will say is we are having a special work session. The yes. Next meeting is going to be March 27th. This is not something that we scheduled until, did I say the 27th? I'm sorry, I'm dyslexic. The 25th, that's a Monday. It should already be on your calendars.
No, it's not. Oh, it's on my calendar. We wanted to make sure it was okay with the group.
That you will send it out. Is that all right? Does anyone have an objective to March 25th? It's post-legislative session, so hopefully you have your legs back.
An exciting note on that, it will be post-move, so that will be at the new Wasatch Front Regional Council offices, which will be over at the gateway on the north end. So,
and you can take the train.
You can. All future meetings after March were address not included, so watch your all your meetings, so we'll have the address, the unit number, directions to how to actually access the new space. So all of that will come, but watch your calendar invites and an email prior to that March meeting. But we'll have a work session prior to the next regularly scheduled meeting.
Right, and the idea is the work session is on the sets.
Correct.
Okay, specifically. And then to this point, when we move to our new office at the north end of the gateway, we're gonna miss this old office, so.
Oh, yeah.
Not really. And it's for sale, by the way. It's for sale. If anybody wants to buy this this office.
I just said how many square feet.
Okay, yeah, we'll send you the sheet on it. But we're moving to these new offices. We're really excited about the first council meeting there is going to be on March 28th. And then immediately following that, we're gonna have an open house and a 50th anniversary of the Wasatch Front Regional Council celebration, and that's on your agenda right here, March 28th from 4 to 6. The council meetings from 2 to 4, and then the anniversary celebration open house from 4 to 6.
Awesome.
One more thing, Abby, just for the record, the motion to adjourn you can vote on it now, but it would take effect at the meeting is still in effect, and adjournment will happen after the video. So watching the video is part of the meeting.
Unless you have already been through the training.
Right? Madam Chairwoman, I would make that motion with that condition noted by our executive director.
Thank you, Michelle. Thank you, Tina, for the second. We'll stand adjourned and we'll play
the video. After the video.
You're my prize.
Yeah, I know. I found myself.
Entities that hold regular meetings
course of a year, need to give public notice at least once a year of their meeting schedule. This notice must include the date, time, and place of the meetings. For entities that do not hold regular meetings, the governing body must give at least 24 hours public notice specifying the date, time, and place. All meetings, whether regularly scheduled in advance over the course of a year, or scheduled as needed, must provide no less than 24 hours notice of meeting agendas. The method of providing public notice for meetings and agendas depends upon whether a public hearing will be held during a portion of the meeting. It is important to distinguish between notice requirements for regular meetings and notice requirements for a meeting that will include a public hearing. If a public hearing is going to be held, the notice must be published in at least one issue of a newspaper. If a newspaper of general circulation is not available, then written notice should be posted in three public places within the entity's boundaries. For regular meetings, an entity is only required to notify a local media correspondent and does not need to pay for the notice if the newspaper chooses not to publish it. Additionally, for public hearings, notice generally must be given at least 7 days prior to the meeting. For both regular meetings and public hearings, written notice must be posted at the principal office of the governing body, or, if no such office exists, at the location where the meeting is to be held. Governing bodies are required to post notice of a public meeting on the Utah Public Notice website. By posting on the website and providing the email of the newspaper or local media correspondent, governing bodies meet the requirement to notify newspaper or local media correspondent. However, all other notice requirements for public hearing, such as publishing the notices in the newspaper, still apply. Typically, posting on the Utah Public Notice website is done by a clerk or secretary. However, it is the responsibility of the governing body to ensure this requirement is being properly met. The public notice website is administered by Utah State Archives, who has prepared a training manual and quick guide for owners and visitors, as well as training sessions that may be accessed on their website at archives.utah.gov.
Thank you.
Public meeting agenda must include the following. Topics to be considered, reasonably specified, and each topic listed under an agenda item on the meeting agenda. The governing body may not consider a topic in an open meeting that was not on the agenda. If a new topic that was not on the agenda is raised by the public during an open meeting, the governing body may discuss the topic. However, final action may not be taken on the new topic during that meeting. If your entity is increasing a fee or undergoing truth in taxation, please be aware that there are additional notice and posting requirements. For help in these areas, please carefully study applicable laws or consult with your legal advisor. In addition to notice requirements, the Open and Public Notice Act imposes certain requirements on the information that must be recorded during a meeting and shared afterward with the public. Meeting minutes and an audio recording need to be kept for all open meetings with limited exceptions. When a meeting, whether open or closed, is required to be recorded, the recording must be complete and unedited. It must include all portions of the meeting from the commencement through the adjournment. Recordings of open meetings must be made available to the public for listening within 3 days of the meeting. Every entity needs to establish and implement procedures for the governing body's approval of the written minutes of each meeting. Pending minutes are written minutes of an open meeting that have been prepared in draft form and are subject to change before being approved by the governing body. Pending minutes must contain a clear indication, such as a draft or pending watermark, that the governing body has not yet approved the minutes, or that the minutes are subject to change until they have been approved. After holding an open meeting, an entity must make the pending meeting minutes available to the public within 30 days. Approved minutes are written minutes of an open meeting that have been approved by the governing body. Approved minutes of an open meeting are the official record of the meeting and must be made available to the public within 3 business days. Whoever is responsible for taking the minutes during meetings needs to be familiar with what the Utah Open and Public Meetings Act requires be contained in the minutes. When a governing body closes a meeting, the following must be publicly announced and entered into the minutes of the open meeting at which the closed meeting was approved. The reason or reasons for holding the closed meeting,
we gotta make a little
the location where the closed meeting will be held,
stronger.
And the vote of each member of the governing body, either for or against the motion to go into closed session.
This is like one of these.
The recording and any written minutes of the closed meeting need to include the date, time, and location of the meeting, the names of the governing body's members present and absent, and the names of all others present, except for where disclosure would infringe upon the confidentiality necessary to fulfill the original purpose of closing the meeting. Great job. You've now finished the Open and Public Meetings Act video. You're ready to move on to the video evaluation.
Yeah, you know that's cool. It's the old Fairchild semi.